ask them to check the roll of attorneys. Robbie's name wouldn't be there. As that affirmation sank home, Mort grabbed his forehead with both hands.
"This is impossible," said Mort. "Can't you reverse this? What if he just goes over to Bad and tells them he changed his mind?"
I said stoically, I was certain that wouldn't work. Robbie added that he didn't want to change his mind. He wanted to be with Rainey, no matter how long or short her time.
"Be with her," said Mort. "I want you to be with her. We could have worked that out. You know that. You didn't have to commit suicide as a lawyer. Look what you've done to me."
Mort sat in his chair, making noises and hugging himself. He ran his hands again through the frizz of hair that was haloed by the strong light emerging from the window. Then, without a backward glance at his partner, he bolted to the door as quickly as his awkward gait allowed.
"Morty!"
Robbie called and took off in pursuit. At my desk, I felt awful for Mort, and even worse when I thought how enraged he'd be when he discovered the whole truth. He was going to be buried for years in litigation with former clients and vengeful ex-opponents. God knows what he'd say about me. I didn't sit still long, however. I requested the men's room key from the receptionist, Danny, and moved urgently in that direction. Male pattern baldness, hair in all the wrong places, the swells of fat that took permanent residence over the hip bones. A friend of mine had suggested that the changes of male middle age were the Darwinian mechanism to ensure that younger women were not persuaded by our attempts at romance. Under this theory, the prostate enlarged just to be certain that we couldn't sit still long enough to try. I circled out the side exit, heading down the dim service channel between my space and my neighbor's. The heavy door to the main corridor had been propped open, and from the darkness, I saw Robbie arrive by the elevator where Dinnerstein was already waiting. I expected remonstrations or, on the other hand, efforts at rapprochement. Instead, Dinnerstein gave Favor a faint smile. After a second, Robbie reached in his pocket for change and flipped a quarter in the air. Dinnerstein immediately did the same thing. I'd seen them play this game a few times before as they awaited the elevator in the lobby. It had been ongoing since childhood, one of the few forms of physical competition where Mort stood an even chance. The contest combined juggling and gambling. They flipped coins simultaneously, each calling his coin in the air while the other caught it. There were complex rules about how to win, doubled bets in some circumstances, and a provision that missing a catch forfeited all winnings. After almost 40 years, they sent the coins back and forth at astonishing speed, catching and releasing in a single motion, while the quarters sparkled in the air. They played happily for a moment, before the elevator dinged at their rear. Favor sprinted ahead to hold it as Mort limped in. I continued staring into the empty corridor, adding it up. I knew nobody reconciles that quickly. Even so, I was disconcerted enough that it took me a second to accept that I'd been taken in again. And this time not only by Favor. Figuring out why came faster. Mort knew. Mort had known all along that Robbie had no license. Suddenly, it was not really imaginable that Robbie Favor, Mort's soulmate since the age of 6, and his law school roommate, hadn't shared his plight. In fact, it explained why Mort had been slow to come practice with Robbie. They'd waited until it was certain that Robbie could actually get away with it. Then they'd proceeded with an obvious contingency plan. In the event of discovery, to protect Mort's license, both of them would deny Dinnerstein ever knew. I was beyond being shocked by Robbie. But Mort! I'd completely bought his routine in my office. Mort knew, I thought again, and with that realized he almost certainly knew much more about his uncle and Kosick, about the judges. Robbie had been shielding him from the start, just as Sennett, a stiff-necked cynic, had always insisted, and even as I had frequently feared. All of this provoked the predictable responses, chagrin and frustration, and several random curse words. Given what Robbie had already done to himself, I shuddered to imagine the kind of time inside he would catch if Stan could ever prove this. But Robbie knew that, and was doing it anyway. As I rushed the last few steps to my destination, I was afflicted by a feeling I didn't expect. Envy. I envied Mort, envied him everything he got from Favor. The dedication, the fellowship, and especially the truth. Chapter 30.
Magda, it's Robbie.
Robbie?
Favor.
Robbie Favor?
There was nothing for an instant as she tried to parse her confusion. It was May 17th. The lead from the recording earpiece Robbie wore ran directly to the tape machine in the cabinet where the 7-inch reels turned with the slow precision of doom. McManus and Even were beside me at the table. Neither they nor Klecker, who was standing, had the heart to look long at Robbie. Sennett had not even shown up, recognizing that his presence would be inflammatory.
I was thinking I could see you.
See me?
Magda was cautious by nature, precise.
Robbie,
she started. Beginning again, she took up the strict tone of the courtroom.
I think that's a very poor idea. No, I need to see you. Just for a minute. I need to talk.
Talk?
Talk.
No.
She took a beat to think about it and said again. No.
Magda, this is really important. Life and death. I mean it. Really, life and death.
Robert, what could be life and death at 9 o'clock in the evening?
Magda, I can't do this on the phone. I have to see you. I have to. Please.
Robbie drew his lower lip under his teeth to gain control of himself, then went on cajoling.
Only a minute,
she stated at last, and gave him the address.
Earlier this afternoon, McManus had filed an emergency motion under the Extraordinary Writs Act to set aside the prior judgment in Hall v. Sentinel Repair, the contrived case that had gone from Judge Sullivan to Skulnick. The original complaint had alleged that Herb Hall, a truck driver, had suffered severe burns and been rendered a paraplegic when the 16-wheeler he was driving for a hauling company had lost its brakes on a downhill grade. Hall had sued the repair service that had supposedly examined the truck immediately before it went out on the road. According to McManus's motion, Moreland Insurance, in behalf of the service, had settled soon after Skulnick issued Judge Sullivan's ruling, allowing Hall to seek punitive damages. Now, Moreland had learned, through Herb's former mistress, that Herb in reality had fallen asleep at the wheel. It was this fact, not brake failure, that accounted for why no tire marks had been found at the crash site. McManus further alleged that the idea for Herb to blame the repair company rather than himself came from Herb's attorney, Robert Simon Favor, who tutored Hall on what to say. The hope, as always, was that if Robbie was successful in reaching Magda, the judge would rule on the basis of briefs. But if a hearing was necessary, I'd agreed with heavy heart to appear in court acting as the attorney whom Favor, if he wasn't being the proverbial fool, would be expected to hire. As soon as the call to Judge Medzik was finished, Klecker wired Favor. They were sending Robbie out tonight, not only with the Foxbite, but also with the portable camera Klecker had installed in the briefcase matching Robbie's. A fiber-optic lens was hidden in the hinge, and the camera, the same kind as the one installed in Skolnick's Lincoln, was powered by a lithium battery the size of a brick, concealed in the case. The point, however, was not improved evidence gathering. Robbie's instructions were to keep the camera pointed at all times not at Magda, but at himself. They wanted to be sure he didn't signal her somehow. Before Robbie left, McManus took me aside, stating tersely, "We expect the usual Academy Award performance." He made no apology for not trusting Robbie, and favor, when I spoke to him alone to impart the warning, required none. His mind was on Magda, anyway. "I want you to realize something," he told me, pausing to impart a stark look. "I did the right thing in the first place, when I didn't tell these guys about her." At her door, Magda Midzik grabbed her house dress by the throat and looked both ways down the hallway before letting Robbie in. With the weight of the case, Robbie couldn't keep from swinging his arm, and as a result, they were both in and out of the fisheye. But you could have seen from the street she was worried. Given the tight look of her hair, I imagined that she'd spent the time while Robbie was on the way taking down her pin curls. They stood in the dim front hall of her apartment. "I hope this is really necessary. I'm so uncomfortable, Robert. I can't believe I allowed you to talk me into this. I was hoping I was mistaken, but I have the papers right in my briefcase. A motion was filed this afternoon. Did you realize you're at issue before me?
Hey, I've talked you into a lot of things you think are terrible."
Stepping forward, he set the briefcase down and was momentarily out of sight, but Magda's voice was clear.
"No, absolutely not. Not now, really," she said.
More quietly, she added,
"My mother's asleep right down the hall."
She'd stepped back into the picture again and cast a desperate look over her shoulder. In the funhouse mirror distortions of the lens, I could see the apartment behind her, a railroad flat with heavy, dark furniture in the living room, including a console TV with a 13-inch screen, the likes of which hadn't been manufactured in at least a decade. As they moved off to the kitchen, the image bounced along impossibly on the monitor in the surveillance van. We were parked beneath one of the grand century-old elms that rose in the parkway in front of the hulking three-story tenement. The sound also took on a bit of a buzz under the kitchen's fluorescent lights as Favor tried to make conversation. She cut him off abruptly.
"It's probably best, Robbie, if you just state your business."
As he pretended to wrench the cover story from himself, she sank down to a wooden spindle chair by a small table. "He had some trouble here," Robbie told Magda, referring directly to the motion McManus had filed. "It hadn't been the way they made it sound. He'd never trump up a case that way. But he'd beaten the tar out of Moreland over the years, and the insurance company wanted him. They were cutting a deal already with Herb Hall to roll over against Robbie. If she granted this writ," Robbie said, "the company would sue him instead of Hall to recover everything it had paid out. Then, once they'd picked $1 million out of his pocket, they'd turn him over to Bad and the prosecuting attorney. He'd be lucky to stay out of Rudyard, and the only thing of value in that license on his wall would be the frame." Robbie had set the briefcase down on the kitchen counter, and we had a good view of the scene. He was opposite Magda at the small maple table where she and her elderly mother had dinner each night. With his long hands, he reached toward her and tossed his head about in distress. She listened at first with her hand over her mouth. By the time he had finished, she refused even to look at him or to speak.
"I need this, Magda, and I'll make it okay for you. I'd want to. No numbers too high. But this is my life, Magda. This is my whole screwed-up life passing before my eyes. You can't let these bastards take it from me. I mean, for Christ's sake, not another word."
With her face averted from Favor and the camera, her voice was somewhat disembodied. Even so, a sound of despair choked out of her with the effort of speech.
When you called, while I was waiting,
she stopped.
I actually prayed this had nothing to do with your case. I prayed. I actually called upon the Mother of God, as if I deserve her mercy. I have only myself to blame, don't I?
Magda, come on, stow the melodrama. I've been before you a lot in the last 10 years. You've ruled for me.
And against you. You know better, Robert. You know much better. I won't have you sit here pretending you don't understand the magnitude of this, of what you're asking. This isn't business as usual, and you know that.
Merely contemplating it forced her to look away from him once more.
Oh, God, she said. God. Please, Magda, think about this. Magda, look, you don't know what goes on around you. You've never stopped to notice. You don't have any idea.
And I don't care to know. Her sharpness seemed to surprise even her, and she planted her mouth on the heel of her palm. He went on pleading until she covered her ears.
Go, she said weakly. Go.
Even then, he begged.
She had to,
until she had finally lost even the power to tell him to stop, and her head of tight, graying curls appeared to droop in assent.
Thank you, he told her, for seeing me, for doing this. Thank you.
He repeated that a dozen times more. When he came around the table to embrace her, she recoiled with her thick arms held aloft. In the last frames before he jerked the camera off the counter, she was bunched in her simple frock, virtually formless in her grief.
She's gonna do it,
said Alf in the van while Robbie was on the way down. I had reached the same melancholy conclusion myself. McManus and Even both nodded. But Robbie had a judgment of his own. Once inside the Mercedes, Favor had apparently taken hold of his briefcase, bringing the lens right up to his face. On the monitor, his features flattened monstrously in the fisheye. But he didn't want anyone watching to miss a word.
That's the worst fucking thing I've ever done in my life, he yelled.
Then I took it, he'd hurled down the camera, because the screen first jumbled, then went completely black. Chapter 31. The next morning, when Even came to pick up Favor, he was gone. She'd waited 15 minutes for him at the foot of the drive, her car window opened to the sweet morning air. Eventually, she went up to the house. Punctuality was normally his sole reliable virtue. The home care worker was new. Elba had returned to the Philippines for 2 weeks for her niece's wedding, and her place had been taken by Doris, a stooped African-American woman who looked as if she needed assistance herself. She had no idea where Robbie had gone, other than having heard him depart in the middle of the night. Even had told herself that she would never feel sorry again for Robbie Favor. But as she'd watched his silhouette plunge wearily toward his door last night, that resolve had eroded. The truth about Favor was that he wasn't actually anything he said he was. Not one thing. He wasn't a lawyer, obviously, and he'd never amounted to dip as an actor. He wasn't even a husband, if that meant keeping to your commitments 7 days a week. But his answer to all of that was that at least he was a friend. That's what he told her when she demanded to know what mattered. His friends. And as punishment for getting caught in one of history's all-time whoppers, Sennett, with his treacherous genius, had pointed his shotgun at Robbie and brought him to his knees, making him look down both of the dark barrels and find out that even the one thing he said for himself was no truer than the rest. Maybe he'd just gone out to get drunk, she figured now, or to stare at the river. After another half hour, she realized he'd probably run. She called McManus from a nearby pharmacy so she could use a wire line. Jim was silent, so long as she had to ask if he was there.
He couldn't run, Jim said finally. He wouldn't leave his wife.
McManus stopped then.
Christ, you better get back and make sure she's still there.
She raced back down the clean suburban streets.
He'd run.
What had Jim said? There was never a bottom with his type. When she arrived, Robbie was in the driveway, just emerging from the Mercedes. He walked slowly toward her. It was probably the first time she'd seen him looking sloppy. He was unshaven. His hair was stirred up, and his face seemed withered by lack of sleep. A placket shirt hung limply over the belt line of his fancy slacks. He was clearly not heading to the office. From the dullness of his eyes, she thought she'd been right in the first place, that he was drunk. But he was moving too well. He turned his head to follow some thought as if it were a butterfly before his attention fell to her again.
My mother died, he said, last night. She had another stroke. She was DOA at the hospital, but they went through some stuff in the ER.
He flopped up a hand from his side, acknowledging the futility of those efforts, and somehow it landed on Evans. It seemed almost accidental, but he permitted himself a brief squeeze before letting go. He looked off toward the apple tree in the yard that was heavy with pink blossoms and made a face. The stroke had been on the other side, he said, so he figured it was, all in all, better this way. 2 years ago, Evans' father had gone in for bypass. Her mother and she and five of her sibs, all the girls and one of her brothers, sat together nearly 6 hours in the contour chairs of the surgical lounge. In her anxiety, her mother had been herself, only more so, carping about the nurses and going from child to child, finding fault. Evan had decided to leave, had actually gotten to her feet, when the doctor came out to tell them that her father hadn't made it. He had been a large, red-faced figure, with thick arms and a substantial belly straining the buttons of a gingham shirt. His thick fingers were calloused, the nails always cracked and never free of dirt. He smelled of the land at all times. She had known him mostly as a presence. He spoke little, even when he was sitting around joshing with the neighbors. He treated her mother kindly, but with the same somewhat distant air they all experienced. He was uncomfortable with feeling, and always wanted to be away from it, safe in the realm of chores and routine. He'd split with his own family when Evan's mother quit the church. He spoke to his brothers occasionally, but not his parents. In her entire life, Evan couldn't recall his mentioning his mother or father more than twice. How had he done that? He was gone, never fully known, and yet he still reared up in her dreams and thoughts countless times a day, and always with a lingering, twisted pain, as if somewhere in her something had been torn up by the root. Robbie said he had already called Mort, who was working on the funeral arrangements. Now he had to tell Rainey. Before he started up the driveway, he asked Evan to go to the office to take care of the mail and help Mort reschedule the depths and other appointments for the next few days. No problem. She had no will left to rebuke him. He looked at her pathetically, unwilling to move. She realized what he wanted. In the house, his wife would not even be able to lift her arms to him in consolation. She reached out just to touch him, but he flowed toward her and swarmed her in an embrace, which she reluctantly returned.
You're a tough cowpoke. You're going to make it. You let me know what I can do.
He didn't let go of her even then. He had begun to burble. When he stood back, he grabbed his lip and continued to cry, his face crushed by the pain.
She was just so much, he said. She was so much.
News of the death had circulated through the office by the time she got there. There was a dismal air that seemed to go beyond mere respect for the boss. Mort was on his way out to sit with Robbie at his home and asked even to follow up on several details related to cases. He stood at the opening of her cubicle. He was in his suit, but his tie was already removed, an emblem that business as usual had been suspended.
"How's he going to take all this?" Mort asked her.
He, too, appeared on the verge of experiencing his famous vulnerability to tears.
"It's too much," Mort said.
He sobbed then and smashed his face into his hand, but could not move, desolated by Robbie's future. The funeral was the following day. Jews traditionally buried with speed, Eileen explained. Everyone from the office was going, so Evan was spared any decision. Mort phoned as she was leaving her apartment.
"We have a big problem," he said.
Doris, the home care aide, had not shown up. Robbie had suspected from the start that the job was too much for her, and the notion of 100 people traipsing through the house for visitation had apparently pushed her beyond her limit. Mort had sent Robbie off to the funeral home, promising to handle this, but he had called a number of agencies and none of them could produce someone before the early afternoon.
"My mom was a nurse," Mort said, "so she could do it, but, you know, I think he'd really want her there. Considering the circumstances, I can call one of his cousins, but I thought you might be able to think of somebody. Lorraine's sleeping most of the time now anyway, but it would be nice if it's somebody she's met."
She could tell Mort was angling. His cagier side grew more apparent each day. He kept minimizing what he was asking. There was less than an hour to the funeral, the service wouldn't last long, and a number of people would then return to the house. There seemed no way to say no, and he thanked her enthusiastically when she finally offered. But she felt exasperated once she put down the phone. She decided to call back and wriggle out. It didn't really fit the cover. People would wonder, wouldn't they, about Robbie's girlfriend caring for his wife on the day of his mother's funeral? No, she saw then, they wouldn't. They would think, that's Robbie fever all over. By the time Evan arrived in Glen Eyre, Mort had gone off to the funeral parlor, leaving his wife, Joan, behind. She was a tiny, thin woman, pretty in a way, but drying up and bowing just a bit in the hormonal retreat of oncoming middle age. She was dressed in black crepe and pearls and had been setting up coffee pots for the crowd that would arrive here from the cemetery. She showed Evan what Mort had shown her about Rainey's care, as he'd been instructed by Robbie. There was no telling what had been forgotten or misinterpreted in the many retellings, but the basics were apparent. The bedpan, the sustacal in the kitchen for Rainey's lunch. When Evan realized moments later she was alone with Lorraine, she nearly sent a scream rebounding through the empty house.
My God, what if she killed her?
Then she sealed off all of that like the hatches in a submarine on the verge of descent. Rainey slept for nearly half an hour after Evan arrived. She was wearing a full oxygen mask now, a transparent plastic shape covering her mouth and nose. Her breathing was growing more shallow every day. She had no energy to leave the bed, and Evan knew that soon she would be engirded in something called a cuirass, a negative pressure device to assist in drawing air into her lungs. But that could put off only so long the ultimate crisis of whether she would allow the installation of the mechanical ventilator. Robbie remained hopeful of persuading her as the time for decision drew nearer. When Rainey woke, Evan reminded her who she was and swung into place the hospital tray that held the computer mouse and its pad, lifting Rainey's fingers onto it. Lorraine was far more adept with the speaking machine than she'd been only a few weeks ago. She scrolled through lists of words, clicking rapidly. "Oh, I know who you are," the bleating boy's voice said. Even without any emphasis, there was something ominous in the choice of words. Even had no idea what to do if Rainey began to pelt her with the kind of abuse she sometimes hurled at Robbie. He said he'd actually turned off the volume on the speakers on a couple of occasions, but she had no right to be so callous. She busied herself instead. She pulled the covers back on the bed and buttered Lorraine's flaccid arms with almond-scented lotion. But Rainey was not about to be put off. "He is such a great liar," Rainey said. "Do you know what he says about you?" Even stopped. A clutch of devastated feeling was already gathering in her chest. "He says you are a lesbian." Even laughed, longer than she might have, but for the relief.
"I am."
Expression remained alive in the submerged depths of Rainey's eyes, which contracted somewhat in doubt.
"He talks about you."
"We work together. We're friends. Robbie has lots of friends."
Even found a pillow and pulled Rainey to her side and put it behind her. She'd seen all of this done with her grandmother. Her skill was amazing to her, the ease and naturalness of it once she started. At the side of the bed, she placed her face near Rainey's on the pillows.
"We aren't lovers," she told her.
Even with her body wrecked, Rainey clearly craved to believe her. But she had been hardened by the disappointments Robbie regularly delivered. Rainey circled there in the ruinous back and forth of doubt and longing. Even read to her for some time. Robbie had begun mitigating circumstances, and even went through several chapters. No doubt she was a poor substitute for Robbie and his stagecraft. Even to herself, she barely sounded more dramatic than Rainey's voice machine, and she was not surprised when Rainey dropped off again. She awoke with a pathetically contained shudder that reached only her right arm and foot. Her eyes sprang open, and the palest rasp of sound emerged from her, almost certainly meant to be a scream. Even could feel the pounding when she touched Lorraine's cheek.
"I dream I'm dead all the time."
Even closed her eyes, caught on the barb of her own dread. It came back to her a second, like some bitter, regurgitative mess rising with a hiccup.
"That must be frightening," she said.
"In some ways."
Lorraine took her time in thought, then described the dream. She had seen her mother-in-law.
"We were wearing the same hat. It had a peacock plume on the front."
Rainey paused for several breaths amid the bare whooshing of the oxygen tank.
"But then I wanted to take it off and realized I couldn't. That was frightening. But it's not usually that way. They say dreams are wishes. Have you heard that?"
She had been a psychology major, so she probably had. She'd figured she was going to learn to understand people that way. These days, the thought of it made her laugh.
"You know, he's promised me."
Somehow, even was beginning to discern expression in the squawking from the computer's speaker. It wasn't possible, she realized. Yet this dry, adenoidal male voice corresponded more and more to the broken person now shaped like a question mark in the bed. "What was it he'd promised?" even asked. She took Rainey's hand and touched her brow.
"He's promised he'll help me. Whenever I tell him, he swore to me."
Unconsciously, she had tightened her grip on Rainey's fingers and barely had the presence of mind to release them. Lorraine was undeterred. She went on describing the arrangement she'd reached with Robbie long ago,
when she'd learned about the disease's inevitable progression. She'd made him reaffirm the agreement only recently, when she'd begun to lose the last control of her limbs. It petrified even to listen to this. Rainey's voice poured from the speakers at the same volume as before, words that should have been hushed. It was not the act or the idea that frightened even, so much as contemplating the moment it would be for both of them. But Rainey seemed at ease. The certainty of a reprieve, an outlet, a way to end the suffering, seemed a part of bearing it. "Don't let him back out. Don't."
"No," Even said, more as a reflex.
"Promise."
God, she was a cluck, Even thought of herself, never even to suspect this, particularly given Robbie's long-standing desperation to be certain he was free throughout Lorraine's decline. "Robbie," she thought, "good or bad, you'd just never get to the end." "You can't ask me that, Rainey."
"I suppose I can't, but I ask all his friends." She slept again, and Even herself drifted off, waking at the sudden sound of voices downstairs. Joan had returned, along with Mort's mother, a stout woman with a white bun. Linda, one of Robbie's cousins, wore a hairdo that looked harder than an insect shell, and so much jewelry she glittered like a Christmas tree. The women had returned following the service to ready the house for the remainder of the crowd, which would begin arriving after the interment. There had been nearly 900 people at the mortuary, they told her, enough to fill a second chapel, where the ceremony was broadcast on closed-circuit TV. Center City must have been a ghost town with the exodus of Favor's friends, lawyers, clients, court personnel, the legion whom Robbie amused and aided. Joan worried that the house could be overrun. Even helped the women carry in a dozen heaping trays of cold cuts which had been sent to Mort's house by friends offering comfort. The new home care person, a grandmotherly Polish immigrant, came in at the same time. She had a heavy suitcase, and Joan, who knew the house, showed her where she would be staying. Rainey was awake when Even went back up.
"Cavalry's arrived. I guess I'll be going."
"Come back,"
she promised that.
"I'm sorry for before. I say things now. Sometimes I don't believe I even thought the words that are coming out."
Even took her hand again. "She didn't mind," she said. What Rainey feared wasn't true, and she was glad she could reassure her.
"It's your loss anyway," Rainey said. "That's what he would tell you."
Humor. Even smiled. She was sure he would, she thought. Rainey's eyes darkened in the labor of a more serious effort.
"You would think I wouldn't mind now, finally, sick and twisted as my body is. But I still want him, always to. I can still feel that there and do it. Did you know that?"
Hardly.
The astonishment must have crept through her face. "It's the one thing left. I think I'm hornier than ever. It probably sounds vulgar or perverted, but it's not. It's wonderful to feel him around me, to think he wants me, even now. So broken and ugly. They say it's the partner who loses interest, but he hasn't. And I'm so grateful. We love each other, you know."
"I know,"
Evan said, and found a tissue to blot Rainey's tears, creeping to the pillow even while her hand clicked away on the mouse. "He hurt me too much, and I hurt him back. We hurt each other every way you can, but I love him, and he loves me. I never knew it the way I did after this happened, but that's why I'm living. Isn't that strictly amazing? I'm not alive, really, and I'm still living for love."
The new nurse's assistant entered energetically, talking in an accent that Evan could barely decode, but she greeted Rainey lovingly and clearly knew her business. She propped up Rainey and straightened the sheets, transforming the bed in such short order that Evan was predictably embarrassed by her relative incompetence. After an uncertain moment, she leaned over the bed and embraced Rainey quickly. Downstairs, a short time later, through the large living room windows, Evan saw Robbie arrive in a long limo. His mother's younger sister from Cleveland was with him, and he held tight to the older woman's arm as she wedged herself out of the car. Evan caught them in the foyer. Robbie was pale, and his features appeared loosened by a bleary uncertainty. His elderly aunt, humpbacked from age, seemed temperamental and largely unmoved by the day's proceedings. Somewhat crossly, she asked for directions to the powder room. When he returned, Robbie offered to walk Evan out. He was on automatic pilot again, talking as they drifted down the drive. Once, he said, when he was 8 or 9, his mother had taken him fishing during the white bass run up near Skagen. He'd been getting in trouble, lifting stuff from the 5 and dime, and his mother was convinced the problem was a lack of manly activity and attention. In the retelling, Robbie marveled over the sight of Estelle, who would never leave the house with so much as a wrinkle in her nylons, appearing that morning in a flannel shirt and old hat. She later told him that after 2 hours rocking in the river, she'd become seasick to a point where suicide seemed sensible, yet she'd given him no clue that day. They were near Evan's car, parked at the foot of the property. The neighbor's lilacs, white and soft purple, were open and as sweet on the air as cologne. His mother had been laid to rest on a glorious day. Evan turned her face up to the perfect sky and found him watching her when she looked back. "This was spectacular of you," he said. "I can't even tell you what it means to me. I really can't. This is one of the nicest things anybody's ever done for me in my life." She answered with the thought that had been circulating unvoiced most of the morning. "You'd have done it for me," she told him, and that harp string in her center sang out, plucked by the truth. You could never count on him for honesty, assuming he even knew what it was. He was unruly and incorrigible, but if she stumbled, he'd come running. She couldn't even say for sure she'd be able to reach out when he extended a hand, but he'd be there. She wasn't going to forgive him, really, but she had to stop pretending with herself. 900 people had just turned out, all there to buoy Robbie Fever in his grief, nearly everyone a friend who'd experienced his openness and the soothing warmth of his care. And she was one, too. You couldn't fight facts. She asked how he was holding up. "Eh," he answered, and let feeling swirl him off elsewhere for a moment. "Losing my dad was something," she said. "But my mom being last, and my mom, I can't even imagine." "Yeah," he said. "But I read something once, and I keep thinking about it now. Every little boy loses his mother the first time, the day he realizes he's a man." Evan didn't understand, and Robbie said he hadn't either, not originally.
but the idea seemed to be that boys had to come to terms with the fact that they couldn't be like their mothers. They had to be somebody else. He was still, and his face was heavy in the light. He didn't seem entirely happy with these thoughts. She had decided long ago she wasn't going to be like her mother, probably because her mother had let Eva know she was nothing like her. But the notion of her mother actually disappearing from her life still seemed to suck the center out of the world. It would be as if the force of gravity, which was down there at the midpoint of the earth and which kept it from flying apart, was suddenly missing. Her mother, past 70, still hung out her wash every day, except in blizzards, preferring the touch of mountain air to the hot breath of the dryer. In her mind's eye, Eva saw her there, with the clothespins in her mouth, securing a Tattersall shirt or a sheet to the line, standing her ground, asserting her intentions, while the wash gave in and snapped on the wind. He asked if Eva got along with her. "Some." "She judges. You're always being weighed on her scales. But, you know, she's strong." Her arms went out. "She's big. You know what I mean?" He drifted down the curb line with her. They were interrupted by a neighbor who had awaited his return before bringing another huge tray, piled up like the others, with pale mounds of foods Eva had never really seen and suspected she couldn't stomach. The woman paid her respects and then proceeded up the driveway. He hugged Eva then, before she could withdraw. That was apparently going to be standard now. She only hoped he had the good sense not to do this in front of McManus or Senate. When he was halfway to the house, he turned and shouted as he walked backwards, just before he disappeared into shadow, "You're great! I love you! I really do!" She realized that somewhere nearby, there was probably a surveillance agent covering her. God knows what he'd seen or heard. That'd be some 302. The cooperating individual then stated to UCA Miller, "I love you." Great. She'd recognize the agent by the size of the shit-eating grin he'd throw her through the driver's window. And what was she to respond? "We're just friends?" But when she settled in the Chevette, she caught a glimpse of herself in the rearview mirror and spied traces of a cheerful look. How could that be, amid all this anguish and misfortune and flat-out confusion? She took herself to task, then gave up. What the hell, she thought suddenly. Really, what the hell? She put the car into gear and felt the spry, lively wind of spring as soon as she lowered the window. Chapter 32. The next morning when I came in, Danny, my receptionist, had taken a message from the U.S. attorney, Stan Sennett, asking if I could arrange to see him in my office at 12:30 with my colleague, which was how he referred to Robbie. Favor, who was at the nursing home to begin the dismal business of sorting through his mother's effects, was cranky about being summoned, but he arrived on time, still with bleared eyes and appearing vaguely disheveled, as he'd been when I'd made a condolence call the prior evening. "What's this about?" he asked. I hadn't a clue. Stan's mood when Danny showed him in was quite formal. He was in his usual immaculate blue suit, and he took the trouble to shake Robbie's hand, which I didn't recall him bothering with before. He expressed his sympathies, and, finding them tepidly received, put himself down in the maroon chair Robbie usually occupied. Sennett spent a moment arranging himself, reaching down to straighten the crease on his trouser leg, before beginning. "I wanted to advise you both of a very unusual meeting I had the afternoon before last. I would have done this sooner but for Robbie's circumstances. It was with an old friend of ours, of all of ours, Magda Medzig." Stan looked into his lap at that point, his expression taut. "She had consulted an attorney that morning, Sandy Stern." Stan nodded toward me. Stern, who reviles Stan for reasons I have never fully understood, is my best friend in practice. That was our good fortune. Mr. Stern declined to represent her, telling her he had an undisclosed conflict. But he suggested she approach me rather than the PA's office, where political allegiances could occasionally become problematic. She waited more than an hour before I got back, and when she came in, she told me a long, somewhat tawdry story about her relationship with a personal injury attorney named Robert Fever. Mr. Fever, she said, had asked her to throw a case the night before. He actually seemed to be offering her money to do it. She wasn't quite certain of that because she was so upset, so alarmed. She didn't follow every word, but there was no mistake that he wanted her to alter the outcome of the case. The judge told me that she will enter an order recusing herself from the matter. But she wanted to inform me first because she was willing, if need be, to wear a wire against Mr. Fever prior to that. Trying to be grave, Stan still could not stifle a smile at the irony. He said that Magda had willingly accepted his guidance. Aside from withdrawing from the case, she would undertake no action or alert any other party in order to allow the government to investigate. She'd await further word from Stan. Sennett waved his chin around to loosen his neck from the grip of his shirt collar before turning to Favor beside him. "She's quite an extraordinary person," Stan said. Robbie did not move. His shadowed eyes remained on Sennett, who, to his credit, declined to look away.
"An extraordinary person?" Robbie finally asked. "Stan, do you know how Magda Medzik spent the night after I left there? Have you got a clue? Because I do. I was sitting there burying my mother yesterday, and I saw Magda like a vision, like it was on TV. I saw her at that little kitchen table all night long. She barely moved. She only got up once to get her rosary. She just sat there begging the Mother of God to help her find some little piece of herself that could go on with whatever was left of her life. Only some sliver of her soul, because the rest of it had been swallowed up by shame."
He stood up then.
"An extraordinary person," he repeated.
He directed one last harsh look at Sennett, kicked over my wastebasket, picked it up, and left. Stan took just an instant to recover. At my door, he tipped an imaginary hat. I found his behavior oddly consistent with my lifetime experience of Stan. Just when I was ready to give up on him, he'd redeem himself. As a line prosecutor, he'd shown all the tenderness of a blunt instrument, but when he became chief deputy PA under Raymond Horgan, he exhibited monumental strength in reforming the office, and especially in loosening the grip of the police force with its political cross-currents over prosecutions. Shortly before he'd married Nora Flynn, her mother, expecting the couple to have children, chose to reveal the fact that she was not Portuguese, as Nora and her brother had always been told, but black. Stan, so far as I could tell, had never flinched. Instead, there had been an admirable support, even an example, in helping Nora come to terms not only with her anger at her mother, but with the uglier stuff that would seep out of the hearts of most white Americans in the same situation. And when, as luck would have it, age later prevented them from being able to conceive, it was Stan who first suggested adopting a child of mixed race. Today he had arrived here, the mountain to Muhammad, with the clear intent to be what was once referred to as a man, knowing Favor would dish out exactly what he had gotten. He'd come anyway, not merely to concede an error, not only to apologize to Robbie or to grant that my anger had been well placed, but to acknowledge that Favor, disingenuous and compromised as he was, remained an able judge of character. Being as coolly objective as Stan, One could say that he was better with principles than with personalities. But as he went on his way, doing his best to look uncrimped, he left behind the saving information that he remained subject to the discipline of his own beliefs. The following Thursday, the week before Memorial Day, Robbie resumed his activities. With Evan, he returned to Judith's to deliver the money Sherm had demanded. Judith, who'd plainly had a merciless ruction with her brother, refused even to look at Robbie, but the envelope went in the register drawer. Amari and his watchers had better luck this time in trailing the funds. Crowthers himself arrived for a late lunch and casually took the small white envelope from Judith, his hand lowered to his side while he was joshing with the kitchen staff. His first stop in the courthouse, even before his own chambers, had been at Kosick's small office adjoining Tui's. The wiretap, briefly activated, revealed little more than greetings. Something hit the desk, but no one could say for certain it was money. Somehow Kosick knew the source of the payment already, or perhaps out of extreme caution, sources were never identified, because nothing about that had been said. But there was no question Rollo had received a share. No more than 2 hours later, Kosick paid for steak dinners for Brendan and himself at Shaver's, an old-fashioned joint not far from their home. One of the surveillance agents, seated only 2 tables away, had watched Rollo lay a $100 bill in the plastic folder in which the tab was presented. The agent jumped up and asked if Kosick minded exchanging 5 twenties for the C-note, claiming he wanted to fill a graduation card for his nephew. Not only did the serial number match one of the bills Robbie had dropped to Judith earlier, but Lifts raised a thumbprint so large the agents were all convinced, correctly as it turned out, that it was Sherm's. Kosick was now a long way to being cooked, and Crowthers was fully grilled. There would be no argument that anything Sherm had said to Robbie was merely a rambunctious jest. Despite the middling results with the wiretap, Stan was confident that Judge Winchell would agree to a full 30-day overhear in Kosick's office. Something on Brendan was bound to turn up. Senate reported this information to the UCAs that night, clearly aiming to inspire everybody as they moved into the critical stage. Even had come back to the Center City to attend the meeting, then returned to her apartment. A large mirror with a frame of beveled glass hung as a wall decoration across from the elevator on her floor. Even when she glanced in the usual solemn fashion at her reflection, she knew something was wrong. She could never have identified what was out of place, but once she turned the corner down the narrow hall, she could see the door to her apartment ajar. She stole to the threshold and lined herself up, shoulder to the left jamb, using the palm of her left hand to slowly push the door open. For the 100th time since Walter told Robbie that Marty Carmody thought she was an FBI agent, she longed for her weapon. Inside, she heard someone clear his throat, and then another voice. "Call the locals," she told herself, meaning the Kendall County Police. "Back out and dial 911. She had a cell phone in her purse, but this was the stuff she lived for. The cowboy types on a bust were always there for the power, sticking their .44 Magnum in somebody's ear and calling him motherfucker, hoping for a brownie. She'd never been able to see that as a trophy, since you had to tolerate the stink when you brought the poor bastard in. But for Evan, all roads led back to game day, to the telling moment of precise reaction. She loved to win, loved herself when she triumphed, in the pure, uncompromised way she'd transplanted from that earlier part of her life. She was not calling the locals. She was halfway down the front hall now, spidering along with her backside to the wall. Recently she'd been playing softball, a Sunday pickup game in a nearby park, kind of a boys-meet-girls event. But many of the participants competed seriously, and she'd bought a black graphite bat last week, which was still propped in a corner a few feet from where she was now, in the living room. Ahead, she saw a shadow move. She flattened herself and held her breath. Voices sputtered up once more. She had just placed the source when a middle-aged, slope-bellied copper stopped at the end of the hallway and looked her up and down. He was pug-nosed and fairly cheerful-looking, despite his eyes, which were so small they had barely any whites. He reached to his belt to turn down his radio.
"Lady of the house?" he asked.
"Something like that?" She showed him her key.
"Got a report," he said. "Burglary in progress, but I guess we missed them. You want to step back outside? I'll just finish. Take a minute. Or wait in the kitchen. I've already covered that."
The whole apartment had been tossed. Cabinets, dressers. The officer had a flashlight in his hand and was stepping carefully over the drawers of her bedroom wardrobe and their contents, which had been emptied out here on the meal-colored rug. He was agile for a big man, for somebody his age. In the kitchen, the back door was wide open. There was nothing subtle. The deadbolt had been forced right through the plaster, leaving even now bitter white dust in the air and a crater in the wall the shape of a bowler hat. A piece of wallpaper hung down as if exhausted, and the molding had been pulled straight off, revealing the 3-inch straight nails with which the Finnish carpenters had applied it. "Crowbar," she decided, and was surprised, stepping to the threshold, to see the tool outside still resting on the steel fire escape. "The crowbar they use is on the back porch yet," she called. "You might want it for prints." She'd returned to the living room. The copper looked back into the bedroom for something and took his time in responding.
"You don't get much from that kind of surface," he said, "but I'll take it along."
In the kitchen, an empty plastic bag from the grocery produce section rested on the counter. He asked if she could spare it, and he grabbed the crowbar with that. He laid it on the white formica breakfast bar, pulled a tiny spiral notebook from his back pocket,